You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. What a joy it is to see Margaret Atwood taking such delicious pleasure in the end of the world, wrote Andrew Sean Gear in the New York Times of Margaret Atwood's new novel, Mad Atom, the conclusion of her grand speculative fiction trilogy. In prose that miraculously balances humor, outrage, and beauty, Atwood tells a dazzlingly inventive tale set months after the waterless flood pandemic has wiped out most of humanity. And having friends who just lost their house in Boulder due to the floods, we are close to home here. I will leave it to both Margaret Atwood and our moderator, Sarah Shunlin Bynum, to tell you more about the post-apocalyptic world navigated by the Mad-Atomites, God's Gardeners, and the gentle euphoric Quakers, as well as vicious painballers and the giant Pagoons, a powerful and uniquely perceptive source of bacon and menace. But let me also quote The New Yorker, which said of this book, "Atwood does Orwell one better," which is pretty high praise. Our moderator tonight, Sarah Shunlin Bynum, is the author of two novels, Ms. Hempel's Chronicles, a finalist for the 2009 Penn Faulkner Award, and Madeline is Sleeping, a finalist for the 2004 National Book Award. She was named one of 20 under 40 fiction writers by The New Yorker, and she teaches in the graduate writing program at Otis College of Art and Design. Sarah last appeared here at Aloud as the interlocutor for George Saunders and Bernard Cooper in a program titled The Short Story and the Art of Not Knowing. Margaret Atwood, who really needs no introduction, is a poet, novelist, literary critic, essayist, environmental activist, and a library advocate. She is the author of more than 30 books of fiction, poetry, and critical essays. Her work has been translated into 33 languages. She is the recipient of many literary awards, including the Booker Prize, which she won for the first time in 2000 with The Blind Assassin. It gives me great pleasure. Please join me in welcoming Sarah Shunlin Bynum and Margaret Atwood to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening. Welcome. And welcome to all of you. Thank you for joining us.
So, first of all, before we start our conversation, we have a special guest. And our special guest is Orville Stober, who is the composer of the music for the hymns in the second book of the Mad Atom series, which is called The Year of the Flood. And in The Year of the Flood, there is a green religious cult that raises vegetables and bees on rooftops in a slum. And they try to combine scripture, nature, and science with mixed results. But they have their own saints and their own festivals, and they have saints' days and celebrations and festivals. For instance, Al Gore is a saint in their religion. And there is Saint Al Gore. There is Saint Robert Burns because of those mice. Yeah. No. Saint Diane Fossey is a saint. And there are, in fact, saints from around the world, but they also have some of their festivals celebrate different kinds of animals. They have, for instance, one called Mole Day, which is the festival of underground life, and they have one for Predator Day. And each of these has its own hymn. So Orville is now going to sing a couple of these hymns for you, and here he is. The hymns are in the audio book of the novel, but they're also on a separate CD, which I believe some of them are in the library's store. And we did these hymns in 23 countries around the world, because when we launched the book, we put on a combined musical, dramatic, and book launch performance coupled with bird conservation awareness. It was a novel concept.
To say the least.
Orville was there.
Yes, I'm one of the survivors of the God's Gardeners. I escaped the pain ballers. And this first number is the opening of the year of the flood. It is called The Garden. Who is it tends the garden oh so green? 'Twas once the finest garden that ever has been seen, and in it God's dear creatures did swim and fly and play. But then came greedy spoilers and killed them all away. And all the trees that had flourished gave us wholesome fruit by waves of sand are buried, both leaf and branch and root, and all the shining water is turned to slime and mire. Feathered birds so bright have ceased their joyful choir. Oh garden, oh my garden, I'll mourn forevermore until the gardeners arise and you to life restore.
I had the great, great privilege of being given these lyrics by Margaret, and just amazed at their depth and what they say about the earth and what we need to learn. This is from Adam of the Flood and of the Two Covenants, and it's the Festival of Arks. There would be a sermon, and then we would have a song in the year of the flood. There are 14 sermons and songs from Adam 1. I love this song. My body is my earthly ark. It's proof against the flood. It holds all creatures in its heart and knows that they are good. It's builded firm of genes and cells, neurons without number. My ark enfolds the million years that Adam spent in slumber. And when destruction swirls around, to Ararat I will glide. My ark will then come safe to land by light of spirit's guide.
with creatures all in harmony. I'll pass my mortal days while each in its appointed voice sings the Creator's praise.
Thank you.
So one of the things that these songs demonstrate is so thrilling about entering the world of Mad Atom is that it's so deeply and completely imagined. We don't just get what people are wearing or they're eating or what kind of transportation they're using. We also get the hymns and hagiography of this fringe green religious group. We also get the kind of porn people are partaking in. We get the kind of beauty products they're using. We get the kinds of courses that are offered at liberal arts colleges. Can you tell us a little more about this world and perhaps introduce, for those of you who haven't yet been initiated, some key terms like Quakers and the waterless flood?
Okay, so there are three books. The first one that I wrote was Oryx and Crake, and it appeared in 2003 at the exact moment when Toronto was undergoing the SARS epidemic. So all I had to do was say, I'm from Toronto, and cough like an empty, empty room. Because in Oryx and Crake, it opens with its narrator, whose name is Jimmy, but he has renamed himself Snowman after the abominable snowman, which may or may not exist. We find him living in a tree, believing that he is the last human being on the planet. But there are, because the rest of them have perished in a very swift man-made pandemic, which he happens to know was unleashed by his best friend, Crake. So he's living in the tree, but in the vicinity there are some human-like creatures. We're not exactly sure how human they are, but they're an improvement. They've been genetically engineered to avoid the kinds of problems that we have get ourselves into by eliminating the causes of those problems. For instance, they've got built-in sunblock. I think that would be good. built-in insect repellent, also good. They self-heal through purring. When I first proposed this, there was some pushback, but science has now vindicated the notion that cats purr partly to self-heal. And in fact, we are now being told that if you have a migraine headache, you should put a cat on your head. No instructions as to how to keep it there, but someone will invent that in the future. Anyway, so they self-heal. They're not only vegetarian, they eat grass and leaves with a modification to their digestive system along the lines of the rabbit, with some side effects we won't go into right now. And that means they'll never have to have agriculture. So they won't have to have agriculture or the fashion industry or cotton plantations or any of that. They're all extremely good looking, of course, but they're of all different colors, so they don't have racism. They've all got, however, green eyes, because Craig liked those. They are not aggressive, and one of the best improvements is that they will never suffer from romantic rejection, because unlike us, they mate seasonally, like most other mammals, and just to avoid confusion, parts of them turn blue when they are doing that. So they do have a little courtship ceremony like penguins. So the males offer an object to the females. With penguins, it's a stone. with stockbrokers, it's a box of chocolates. With his, or maybe something better if they're not cheap. With these, however, it is a bouquet of flowers, and if that is accepted, then it's on. It's a go. They do this in groups, so there isn't any worry about specific fathers. Just everybody is the father of everybody.
No paternity test?
No. Well, they don't need those anyway because they don't have any stuff, so there's nothing to inherit.
Yeah.
And therefore, they've done away with jealousy. Is it all good so far? Jimmy finds them very boring. They also have an eerie way of singing that he finds quite irritating. So that this is the world that we begin with, and then we go back and find out how he has come to be the shepherd of the Krakers, because he's kind of watching over them, and whether he really is the last human on the planet. And at the end of the book, in fact, we find out that he isn't, but he has to decide whether to do away with the ones that he's come across, because will they not be a threat to these non-aggressive people? So that's his dilemma at the end of book one. I didn't intend to write three of them when I was writing the first one, but shortly after I finished the first one, I realized that not only was I going to be asked a lot of questions, like what happened, to which I didn't know the answer. So I would have to write these books to find out. But there were also two groups in the books that Jimmy only gets to see out of train windows or on television, because he has grown up in a gated science biotech community. In that particular future, there isn't any government as such anymore. It's all controlled by corporations. And they have their own security force called the Corpsicorp. So in the other two books, I explore these other two groups, one being the God's Gardeners and the other one being the Mad Adamites, who, unlike the God's Gardeners, who are pacifists, the Mad Adamites are conducting an active resistance to the corporate hegemony, which is depleting the biosphere at a frightening rate, unlike today, of course.
Thank you for that beautiful catch-up. And one of the things that I loved about hearing you introduce Orville was that it captured for me how subtle your use of humor is in these books. Because as you were describing the God's Gardeners and their rituals and their feasts and festivals, there was all sorts of laughter and chuckling in the audience. And indeed, when we read about them, there is sort of a affectionate poking of fun at them. And yet, when we hear Orville sing, it's moving and sincere and beautiful. And so I love how the humor is at once, there's sly humor there, but it's also never just one thing. There's also...
No. And this is just anybody who's ever had anything to do with church groups or indeed religions of any kind know that it's like this. So moments of sublimity. And if you look at actual hymns, they're like that too.
Yeah.
You know, moments of wow, that takes your head off, and other moments of how could they have done that? So it is a mixed bag. I once went to a funeral, a solemn occasion, at which the presiding pastor began the ceremonies by telling us where the washrooms were. You know, this is just... So you do get this, you know, we're worshiping the Creator and the kids' Sunday school is going to be, you know, it's like that. And it is like that. So it's not even a question of making fun. That's just what people are like.
Yeah. And the humor also seems to be one way in which, to quote the New Yorker, you do Orville one better. I mean, Orwell, as much as I love 1984, is so gloomy. And one of the things that really animates this trilogy for me is the ever-shifting sense of humor and the sort of generosity of spirit with which this world is portrayed. And I just never expected to be sitting there faced with the end of human civilization as I knew and laughing so much. And especially in Mad Adam, I mean, the humor really comes into full bloom there. There's these great body jokes and there are these wonderful visual gags. I love in particular, the image of Crozier as a new shepherd with his bed sheet, and he has these multicolored mohair sheep. And one of the things that's delightful about this world is that the Krakers are not the only bioengineered species wandering about. There's also pigoons, which we'll talk about, and mohairs, which are sheep who have been designed to grow human hair for the purposes of hair transplants.
Yeah, and this would be a good idea. I offer it to anyone in this room. It's of an entrepreneurial nature. You'd make a killing.
And then my favorite running joke in Mad Adam is the helpful yet invisible deity, Ofak.
I think you're going to have to explain how that came into being. The Krakers employ the vocative. So the vocative is when you say, "Oh, Sarah, where have you been?" So I'm invoking you. So that's just how they address people. So they address Toby as, "Oh, Toby." And they address Ren as, "Oh, Ren." And then they hear Jimmy say, "Oh, fuck." So they wonder, is he talking to you? Who is this person? So Toby has to explain that this is an invisible person, like Crake, who has become their creator in their theology, and this is an invisible helper. And so you call him when you're having a problem. Something has happened, such as you've dropped a stone on your foot. You call him, and he immediately comes to help.
Yeah. So what moved you to write about this future with this generous sense of humor?
Well, I think when you're not actually sinking in the Titanic, if the ship is not actually going down right then with you on it, that you survive a catastrophic event, you're not changed into another person. Mm-hmm. You still are the person that you were before. And I think people often then react to those situations if they're not actually sinking at that very moment with, well, here we are. Okay. Now what? And they're not serious and gloomy necessarily. And
yeah.
I don't know whether I don't know how many cataclysms you've survived, but and just to cheer everybody up, the human race has been through some bottlenecks before,
as it
turns out, and also people have been through some hard times. So this is not, as we say, it's not the end of the world. And there's a very good reason why it isn't. And that is, it's a book. And when it's a book, you have to have some people survive, or there isn't anybody to tell the story. That's a really good reason. And so that's a good reason. So there is, however, something about what they think about their chances. Jimmy doesn't keep a Robinson Crusoe journal in Oryx and Crake because he can't imagine a future reader.
Mm-hmm.
Robinson Crusoe can. He thinks somebody's going to come along.
Yeah.
And he thinks somebody's going to come along and rescue him, and even if they don't, they're going to come along and find the record of his days.
Yeah.
So, but Jimmy doesn't think that, so he doesn't write anything down. Toby does think it. So she does keep a journal.
And in fact, she
She creates a future reader.
She creates a future reader, and she creates a future scribe as well.
She doesn't know she's doing that, but in fact, that is the result, because the Krakers initially can't read and write.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask about this, because written language is tricky in this series, and it raises a lot of questions. And Matt Adams so memorably documents this moment of transition from an oral culture to a written culture. But when we begin in Oryx and Crake, Jimmy, our protagonist, is in fact an ad copywriter, and one feels that language has become, written language in particular, has become very nearly bankrupt. So here's just a little, can I read a little passage that I love when Jimmy's describing his wordsmithing job, where he works for a big pharmaceutical company. "Pills to make you fatter, thinner, hairier, balder, whiter, browner, blacker, yellower, sexier, and happier." It was his task to describe and extol, to present the vision of what, oh, so easily could come to be. Hope and fear, desire and revulsion, these were his stocks in trade. On these he rang his changes. Once in a while he'd make up a word. Tensicity, fibrochinesis, pheromonimal. But he never once got caught out. His proprietors liked those kinds of words in the small print on packages because they sounded scientific and had a convincing effect. So in this world, written language has been demoted to being a mere tool for marketing new biotech products.
Do you read packages?
I know, it's not a stretch, is it?
I do. I read them with great fascination.
It's not a stretch. And Crake deliberately designs the Krakers to be free of symbolic thinking.
He tries that. It doesn't work.
It doesn't. And as you were mentioning, Toby inadvertently introduces the technology of writing to the Krakers, who have cultivated their own vibrant mythology entirely through oral storytelling up to this point. And Toby thinks to herself, surely the Krakers would be happier without it. By teaching them how to document, how to pass these stories on, is she setting them on a path to angst and alienation?
We don't know that. There was a lot of debate about writing when it first appeared in the world.
Yeah.
Some of the Greeks were quite suspicious of it. They felt that by writing things down, you would cause people to lose their memories.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, they would no longer be able to reel off, you know, chapters of the Iliad. And so it has come to be. In point of fact, that's true. So they were right about that. There is an effort now. There are now oral storytelling groups that have sprung up. And there are also some interesting programs. It disappeared for a while. It was there in the 19th century, and then it disappeared for a while. But recitation to an audience, as in Anne of Green Gables, mm-hmm. there were professional recitalists who went around, and they would give whole programs of reciting. With you could get books on the gestures, you know, despair, inspiration. There's pictures of how to do it. I don't think we do that anymore, but that's what they did. They declaimed, in other words.
Yeah.
So there are now poetry memorization and recital contests for high school students,
yeah.
which are popular in this country and also in Canada. And the kids really get into it. And they're very good. I've seen some of these things. They're really excellent.
And all the kids who grew up in the God's Gardeners, they too are trained in this.
They have to memorize. Yeah, they have to memorize. The God's Gardeners do not allow any technology, no cell phones, no computers, because they know quite rightly, and you all know that too, because you've been reading the papers. Their saying is, if you can see it, it can see you. And that just happens to be true. So they use slates and chalk, and then they wipe it out. So they have reverted to even a stage before printed, before newsprint. They're actually using the slates. This is a very, very, very old technology. In Roman times, they used wax tablets that you could write on, and then you could erase them at the end of the day. And when Hamlet says, "My tablets meted as I set it down," that's what he's using. He's using a wax tablet. So you know those tablets we have now. That's where the word comes from.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, from those old tablets that they had. Anyway, something that you can write and then wipe out. Much in use in the ancient world. So the Quakers have gone back to that because they're pretty paranoid.
The God's Gardeners?
The God's Gardeners, not the Quakers, sorry. The God's Gardeners are quite quite worried about, they want to keep under the radar.
Yeah.
They don't, that's why they live in slums. Slums that are so dangerous that the Corpse Corps doesn't bother going there. And there are places in the world like that. Now,
since you brought up Hamlet, I can't resist the opening to talk about Shakespeare. I just read that your next project is an exploration of the Tempest, and I was excited to read that because in some ways the Caliban reminds me of a early modern incarnation of a Quaker, if a sort of male had gotten separated from the fold somehow. So I'm so curious about what drew you to this particular Shakespearean play and what form this revisiting or this exploration might take.
I'm not going to tell you all about that right now because I still have to do it. So it's a proposal like the mythology proposal of Canongate several years ago, which resulted in the Penelope Ed. The mandate was take a myth, any myth, present it in any form you wish, but it shall only be this many pages. So there was a time, there was a space limit set, but other than that, you were free to do whatever you wished. And it took me a while to get around to Penelope. I wanted to write one on the subject of Mouse Woman. Mouse Woman, a well-known divine being among the Haida, who live in Haida Gwaii off the upper west coast of Canada and belong to a language group of one, which is probably why Mouse Woman is not widely known. But and this was my problem trying to write it. I would have had to first explain who Mouse Woman was and etc. So I froze on this project. In fact, I froze so badly that I phoned up my English agent and said, "Do you think Jamie Bing will mind a lot if I don't do this?" Mm-hmm. Frozen pause. "Well, actually, I think Jamie Bing will be gutted."
Oh no.
"But go ahead if you wish." Well, I couldn't gut Jamie Bing, so I very swiftly began to write about Penelope.
Well, we will look forward.
So The Tempest, let us just say that there are a lot of unanswered questions in The Tempest. How did Sycorax get onto that island in the first place? Just for instance. What happens to Caliban at the end of the play? We are not told.
Well, one of Caliban's first impulses upon meeting Miranda, of course, is to populate the island with little Calibans. And one of the, things that this trilogy raises is
who gets to sleep with whom?
Who gets to sleep with whom, exactly.
And it's always been a burning human issue.
Yes.
As far back as we know. And it's been on our minds for a very long time.
And it's wonderful because there's lots of characters who enjoy having sex with each other in your book. And I was also...
That's why they wouldn't understand the true explanation of oh fuck, because they would not understand why that would be a bad thing.
Yeah.
No, just wouldn't get it.
But even the human survivors, I found the physical relationship between Toby and Zeb, I loved how that was traced throughout the book and how much of the storytelling that is the spine of Mad Adam is first shared as a sort of pillow talk between the two of them. But in addition to this wonderful erotic relationship that Toby and Zeb have.
Well, you mean middle-aged sex.
Yes.
It does happen.
I love seeing these two middle-aged characters just loving each other's, sort of discovering each other's bodies and having this lovely time together. And you know, and it's wonderful because none of it's described explicitly, but we infer what's happening based on the dialogue that's being shared between the two of them. So there's a lot of room for imagination.
Yeah. There is this thing called the Bad Sex Award that is awarded by the English, wouldn't you know, to a passage in a book that they think particularly overblown. So you have to keep that in mind.
Right.
You might stray over the edge and end up winning the Bad Sex Award, which you particularly want. They also have an award for the most unusual book title every year. And last year it was won by Goblin Proofing Your Chicken Coop. I immediately ordered 4 copies of it. So I know some people who could use that. Yes, this man has no truck with the fairy world. He must be ruthlessly stomped out. He has one chapter called Gnoming, which the little picture at the top is of a bow and arrow.
Oh, well, I can't quite leave the sex topic yet because
I did my best.
Well, because one of the things that's really striking is that two of the main characters in the trilogy, Oryx and Ren, have both worked in the sex industry. And then in the third book, we're introduced to a third character whose name is Katrina Wu, that Zeb playfully nicknames her Katrina Woo Woo. And we find out that she's the owner of Scales and Tails, which is the sex club where Ren works.
The upmarket sex club.
The very upmarket sex club where Ren works as a trapeze dancer. And one of the things that I was so curious about with Ren, there's so many characters who in one form or another get to share their story over the course of the trilogy, but Ren is the one person who shares her story in first person. Why did you bestow that particular narration on Ren?
Okay, so this would get us into a long discussion about how the first person works as opposed to how the third person works in various of its incarnations,
yeah.
And also how the second person works, because they all work differently.
Yeah.
But one of the things about a novel such as Year of the Flood, in which you have 3 narrative voices, yeah. Each one operating differently. Adam mm-hmm. 1 operates only through his sermons and also through the conversations that other people have with him, but we don't get his inner thoughts.
Yeah.
And I just want you to close your eyes for 1 minute and imagine Wuthering Heights if Heathcliff were telling it in the first person. It'd be quite a different thing.
Yeah.
So then I took it into my mind to hang the dog. It was fun. I enjoyed it. So, or, okay, Pride and Prejudice, Mr. Darcy's thoughts. It wouldn't work the way it does now. Okay, so in a novel with three narrative voices, two of which are women, for the same reason I like to give characters different hair colors and different first letters of their names so that we don't get them mixed up. So we always know when it's Ren talking because she's talking in the first person. We always know when it's Toby because it's in the third person. You're never confused. But also, you can give a voice an age that way that is actually hard to do.
Yeah.
It's harder to do otherwise.
And you so do...
Those are some of the reasons.
Yeah, and you do capture Ren's voice and sort of her being at that cusp of, you know, adolescence coming into adulthood, really vividly.
She's also not the most blazingly bright bulb in the chandelier.
No, she's not.
She's not stupid, but she's not a genius.
No, but let's put it that way. And actually part of what made her endearing to me. And going back to Ren, one of the things that I was really struck by is there's lots of romantic longing and erotic longing in these books, but the emotional bond that I kept thinking about was that of sibling relationships. And Ren, in a sense, sort of adopts an older sister in Amanda. And then, of course, we have the brother dyad of Zeb and Adam One. Zeb is the younger bad boy, and Adam One is the pious founder of God's Gardeners. And I then got to... see in my version of In Other Worlds. In Other Worlds is a collection of essays that Margaret has written about science fiction and speculative fiction. And with the iBook version, the enhanced version, one of the added bonuses is you get these wonderful color reproductions of drawings that you made as a child. But very touchingly, you also include drawings of princesses and flying warriors that your older brother, Harold, made. I'd love to hear sort of about this nature of, and even in a sense, there's something of a sibling rivalry in the friendship between Jimmy and Craig.
A lot.
Yeah, how has being a younger sibling shaped these characters and shaped these choices?
You mean how did me being a younger sibling... I don't know. I was the younger of two, and then I was the middle of three, and I was also therefore the older of two girls.
Yeah.
So I really get to look at the sibling thing from many different angles.
Yeah.
Somebody said to me, so because I explained that I spent my first part of my childhood being the younger of two, the elder of whom was a boy. Mm-hmm. So that when we played with dolls, we did not play Barbie and Ken. We played war. We lined all the dolls up, you know, in two opposing armies, and then we threw them at each other. And the stories and... little books that we made. It was the war, so it was a motif. Yeah. And it was the time when you collected, as a kid, you collected these airplane cards, so we had a lot of material for our war imaginings. But his were all about other planets, and on these other planets, it was pretty much war all the time. And I wasn't quite as interested in that. I noticed in the drawings that I might have a bullet or two, but not the barrage.
The shower.
The shower of bullets and the amazing number of explosions that he has in his. And for that reason, we used to trade the colored pencils and early technology. We traded the colored pencils And he would get the yellow, the orange, the red, and the black to make all of these explosions. And he had no interest in the pink, the silver, the gold, or the flesh color that I needed to make the princesses and the crowns, of course. So it was, you know, even Stephen kind of trade, but there was a lot of war. Somebody said to me the other day, so you got immunized to all of this. So now, she said, that explains a lot. And I also said that we got this unexpurgated Grimm's fairy tales. And she said, oh, were you frightened by that? I said, no, it was our parents who were frightened by it. We weren't frightened by any of these cut off heads or gouged out eyeballs. It was just kind of, you know, life as usual in the world of warfare for us. Anyway, it was quite different with my little sister. She didn't like any of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
She did not go for the gouged out eyeballs. She wanted the Dolly's tea party. They did not, you know, the Dolly's tea parties did not suddenly turn into a battle in her world. So it was quite a different thing. I think it was also, it was the 50s by then, and Disney had got hold of those fairy tales and princessed them up quite a bit.
Yeah.
So those were the ones that she liked.
The princesses now are inescapable. They're,
yeah, yes. They're inescapable, but so are zombies.
Yeah.
So you get the best of both worlds. So the princess zombie, I'm waiting for that. And we had the Princess Bride a while ago, so surely it is now time for the undead princess to come.
When you published the first book of the trilogy, Oryx and Crake, in 2003, you said at the time that you thought of the book as taking place in the near future, 20 years or so down the road, and you also observed that some of the things that you included in that book were galloping at us at an even greater rate than you expected. And now that we're 10 years out from its initial publication, indeed there are several things you imagined in Oryx and Crake that have eerily already come to pass, like the brain tissue being grown in...
The little brains in the petri dishes.
The little oysters.
They do look like oysters, yeah. So the things that already existed at that time...
Yeah.
The spider-goat blend was already in existence, making spider silk in its milk for bulletproof vests. The glowing green rabbit had already been made then.
Yeah.
We've just made some more.
Yeah.
We've cloned them now.
Yeah.
The attempt to grow human kidneys in pigs... for transplant into us was encountering some problems then, but we've solved them. And we can now make viruses from scratch. And I noticed that we have modified the H1N1 virus just in the lab to see what would happen. We do a lot of that. So yes, the biotechnology is indeed building out at an enormous rate, and so are other kinds of technology, and some of that is actually good.
Yeah.
Some of it's good. Our technologies are all tools;
yeah.
They're all neutral in themselves. It's a question of what we use them for, how we apply them, whether we let them out of the box a bit too much. We are on our way to changing from silicone chips to carbon tubes to make our computers, which will vastly reduce the energy consumption, should we be able to do that. So a lot of the technology effort now is focused on something it needs to be focused on, which is reducing our energy consumption while still supplying cheap energy to run the world we live in.
Yeah.
You know, everything you see around you is run on cheap energy. And should the switch suddenly go off, there would be a lot of very confused people. And then there would be a riot.
So in some senses, these leaps in technology have both hastened the arrival of a future in Mad Atom, but also in a sense maybe forestalled a little bit of that future now that this technology is being used to conserve energy.
Not enough yet.
Yeah.
Not enough yet. It's a question of scale.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's all pretty interesting. We do live, I suppose everybody thinks they live in the most interesting moment of time, but we do live in the most interesting moment of time. And I met a physicist the other day with this news just in. Time is real after all. I'm so relieved. For a while there, we were being told that it didn't really exist, that everything that was going to happen had, in some sense, already happened, and therefore the future was closed. But now that time exists again, the future is open. And therefore, we can make choices that will have real effects.
And that's one of the gifts that your book gave me as a reader, was it awakened me to the ways in which we are living in this interesting moment in time, so that, you know, things that I wouldn't make connections between before, you know, hearing a story on NPR about the first lab-grown hamburger, and then getting a notice from our private security company that 26 more neighbors have subscribed. You know, that these the patterns that you delineate so indelibly in Mad Atom, those patterns I'm now seeing in my daily life in a way that I didn't necessarily see before.
Is that a good thing?
I think it makes me much more conscious about this question of choice.
Yeah, okay, that's a good thing.
So it's awakened me to choices that I need to make so that some of these patterns perhaps get disturbed or interrupted or reprogrammed. So Margaret, I hate to end the conversation, but I also want to open up to the audience. But before we do so, we have a wonderful musical segue, and Orville is going to join us
for a final song.
A final song.
And here he comes.
Yeah.
Gardner song, right?
Yes, it's a peppy one.
Peppy, peppy, peppy. Went Adam first. And gratefully, we had a copy of The Year of the Flood, and I got the lyric. When Adam first had breath of life. No, that's not right. When Adam first had a breath of life, all in that golden place, he dwelt in peace with bird and beast, and he knew God face to face. Now man's spirit first went forth in speech and name each creature dear, and God called to all in fellowship. Well, they came without a fear. Here they go. Well, they romped in play, they sang and flew. Each motion was praise. Well, God's great creativity filled those early days. How shrunk, how dwindled in our time, creation's mighty seed. For man has broke the fellowship, with murder, lust, and greed. Oh, creature dear that suffer here, how may we love restore? We'll name you in our inner hearts and call you friend once more. Without fear, once more, hand in hand,
once more. Without fear, once more. Hand in hand, once more. Come on! Without fear, once more. Hand in hand, once more. Without fear, once more. Hand in hand, once more. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello. My name is Meredith. Thank you for coming here. It's such a pleasure to hear you speak in person. I was curious about the nature of, I guess, how you came to include so much music in your work. And I understand that you have a, you obviously have an amazing way with words, and you're a poet as well. But I wondered if perhaps as you were working on this trilogy that became a trilogy from your first book, if the music was a natural progression, if you perhaps dreamed some of the music, because I've heard of that happening. But I'm really curious about the music, and I very much enjoyed the auditory aspect of creation that you brought to this world that you've shared with us.
Oh, okay, so that's a complicated question. I think that music is one of the things that come with the human kit. You know, we come with it. So anything that you see small children doing before the age of about four that you are not kind of hammering into their heads, they just pick up from their environment. And that would include learning languages. It would include experimenting with substances and making images, visuals. And it would include narrative, which they show very early. They can understand a story from about the age of one, and they can retell it as soon as they have the words to do that. This happened, then this happened, then this happened. And music, you can see them really early. You know, the rhythm, the making of the sounds, the little singing, little songs that they have. So it's just it's a human thing that comes with. In the Krakers, it is it takes another form. They have a special kind of singing all of their own, which turns out to be a language, as it turns out. Music was one of the things that their creator attempted to eliminate from them, but he could not do it without turning them into zucchinis. That is a quote. So for me, how shall we approach this? I grew up with music in the family because people sang. In those days they sang. We got music in school. It is not a frill in my opinion. It's something human beings do, and it's demonstrably helps to develop young brains, and it also it's apparently quite helpful to have a musical instrument that employs both hands. Musical instruments are very, very old, by the way. Even Neanderthals had them. We just have a very close connection with music, so it seemed obvious to me that if you were going to have a religion, it would have music, because everyone that we know about does. You know, it would not be conceivable to have one without music of some kind. Where would you like to go from here? We did learn some quite peculiar songs in second grade. I could give you a rendition of some of those if you would like. Yeah.
Question on your right. Hi. You have an extraordinary ability to see, imagine, foretell, and not be afraid to tell us about societal and global trends and movements and things that you see coming. whether it's, you know, online banking everyone needs to read The Handmaid's Tale, how that all works out. The plea bands exist, we know this. But I remember very vividly on 9/11 that you had written about the towers of industry crashing and falling. So I'm really curious about on that day or the days after 9/11, your personal, not feelings, but your intellectual response. Did you say, but of course, we all know this was going to come?
No, okay. First of all, no one can really predict the future. It is open. There isn't the future. There's numerous possibilities. So I'm not predicting anything. You can imagine it, and we all can do that. In fact, we are now being told by the brain guys that memory did not evolve to allow us to remember the past. It evolved to allow us to anticipate the future. So if you killed the gazelle over there, maybe you're going to get lucky again and do that next week. So like that. On 9/11, I was sitting in the Toronto airport about to board a plane for New York, where I was going to go down and give a reading in Union Square. Mm-hmm. So I was there knitting away, because in those days you could knit. They had not yet, banned knitting needles on airplanes, knowing as they do now that you might come up to them and say, you know, take me to Havana or we're going to knit you to death. You can, I think, bring crochet hooks on. So nobody's worried about that. I'm going to crochet you. So I was knitting away and wasn't paying attention to anything. And a friend of mine called Jerry happened to be there. I hadn't seen him, but he saw me and he came over and he said, I don't think we're going to fly. And I said, oh, why? And he said, look at the television screen, and we saw one plane going into one tower, and we both thought, oh, somebody's had a heart attack, isn't that tragic? And we went and we rebooked our flights for 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I thought, I'll just stay at the airport. So I was sitting there, knitting and looking at the screen, and then this other plane flew into the tower, and I thought, okay, so that is not a heart attack. I'm going to get in a taxi and go home, because nobody's going anywhere. So that is what I did. Did I think, told you so, or any of those kinds of things? No, I didn't. But I'm going to tell you a very eerie thing, which is this. We did an opera of The Handmaid's Tale. It premiered in Denmark in the year 2000. And it's very well done. It's since been performed in England and the States and Canada. But it begins with a scene setting, and the scene setting is a rolling montage of images of what brings about the scary state that allows a totalitarianism to take over. And one of those images is of the two towers coming down. We then had to remove that from the rolling film, because by the time we next did it, that had already happened. So, terrorism through the ages, you know, it's an old story. And people, and it's theater. So I suppose somebody was going to get the idea of, let us do the most visible thing. Let's do something really eye-catching and visible. So I think that's probably the thinking that then evolved. And to tell you the truth, I thought, okay, so this is the plot of Star Wars, where they fly the plane into the heart of the Death Star. In that movie, they get to fly it out again, but it's a movie. But the idea of using a plane as a projectile and flying it right into the middle of something, it's in that movie. And right after, this is Los Angeles, so you'll all understand this. Right after that, the security people hired a bunch of screenwriters, because they plot things out. They take a supposition and they plot it out. So if you were these characters, how would you do this? Well, in the movie, you would do this and this and this, like that. So I think it's like that. I think it comes along with storytelling. So you're telling a story, you're building it out, you're doing what if. It's not prediction. It's screenwriting.
Next question, right over here.
This isn't an intellectual question, it's just a sentimental one. Does Toby find Zeb?
Does Toby find Zeb? In which book?
The last one, at the very end when she goes out.
No spoilers. No spoilers. I like to leave some things open anyway. Always. There's always, it's like saying, so what did Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy have for breakfast on their 40th wedding anniversary? Just some things we're not supposed to know.
Hi, Margaret. Your movie, The Handmaid's Tale, is one of those few movies that I've actually seen more than once. And that's because I read a lot about Mormonism in between the first time I saw the movie and the second time. And I just think that there's just so much of an eerie coincidence. I mean, in terms of choosing religion, if there could be a theocracy in the United States, I think it probably would be Mormonism inspired. But were you inspired at all? I'm just curious. Were you inspired by Mormonism?
Okay, so I didn't put anything into the book, and it was my rule for writing it, that has not already happened in some place at some time. So Mormonism was one of the polygamous religions that I studied, but it is not the only one in world history. I give you the 12 tribes of Israel, which were produced by two legitimate wives and two handmaids. Just for starters. God changed his mind about whether that was a right thing to do. Somewhere in there. We don't actually catch him changing his mind, but there is an obvious trend. Later on, you don't get to do that, let me put it that way. But earlier on, you certainly were. But if you count societies, which ones are polygamous, which ones are monogamous, there are more polygamous ones, in point of fact. So sure, Mormonism, but lots of other things as well.
Next question, right over here. We have two more questions.
In the year of the flood, the Corpse Corps have been taking all the guns for themselves away from individual people in the country.
You would, and, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And the fact that Toby had buried a gun in her father's neighbor's yard is a real important feature of her survival after the flood.
Yes.
And so I'm just wondering if you were taking any positions on, you know, individuals keeping guns in their possession in order to avert totalitarian takeover.
I'm not sure that it will avert it. That is, I think if a totalitarianism is really, really serious, and particularly if they've got a lot of digital trackers. a few individuals with more primitive weapons are probably not going to turn that particular tide. If you're wondering whether what I think about guns. Okay, so I grew up in the North. You had guns because you had bears. And if you go up into the Arctic and go out on the land, you have a bear gun. You would be an idiot not to, because polar bears are not afraid of you. They're afraid of male walruses and you are not a male walrus. They know that. So, yes. Do I think it's a good idea for people to have arsenals of military weaponry in their homes? No. What are they going to be doing with it? The kinds of guns that I'm, as it were, used to and understand are those that are needed for a particular purpose, which is not going up to the top of a shopping center and sort of mowing down everybody in sight. Am I in favor of some form of gun control? Well, that would be nice. I mean, it would be nice if people could not just walk into a store and buy a military-grade weapon capable of, you know, blowing up the entire city block. Is that going to happen? Not anytime soon. The gun lobby in this country is extremely strong. So it's somewhat different. Life is somewhat different in Canada for all kinds of reasons. And one of them is that we're just a lot closer to the north, and a lot more people live there and go there. So their relationship with guns, although they may occasionally use them to murder somebody, their relationship with guns is somewhat more utilitarian, and usually has to do with if the large animal starts coming through your window, you want to be able to have an antidote to that.
Hi, it's been a wonderful pleasure to listen to you speak tonight. You were introduced, among other things, as an environmental activist, and I'm sort of in that arena, so, but I wouldn't have assumed it. Your work covers so many positions, but of course, I'm reading it myself, I felt the kinship, but so it was interesting to hear you introduced as such, and I wondered if you would speak specifically to what forms that takes.
What actually I'm doing.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm working mostly with an organization called BirdLife International. And BirdLife International is the oldest and largest conservation organization in the world. The reason you haven't heard too much about it here is that it works through national partners. So it's a ground-up organization. The national partners will tell the secretariat what is needed, and then the secretariat will go about helping them do that. And for a while, there wasn't a U.S. partner. There is one now. It's Audubon. But there was a period of time there when there wasn't one. But now there is. Anyway, that's the one I put my energies towards. And one of the reasons for that is that with birds you get an overview of just about everything. But it also connects you with people working in every other field. So people working with soil, people working with the oceans. Very important. Do not let the ocean die or you will snuff out because the oxygen will disappear. 80% is made by marine algae. So I think that's why. And I'm the honorary president of something called the Rare Bird Club within BirdLife International. I'm the co-president, the other one being my partner, Graham Gibson, who does most of the actual back and forth with them. And what do we do? We help raise money for projects that then get applied at sort of pivotal points in the with the national partners. You cannot do conservation from the top down. You cannot dictate to people how they should live, what they should do. You just can't do that. You have to listen to them, give them a reason. You know, make it so that it's better for them to do the conservation than not to do it. to conserve their space rather than to make it into a desert like that. So that is, I can see you nodding vigorously away. And so that is what we do. And I have huge admiration for the people who are working in the field in a number of these countries, because it's jolly dangerous. And one of the saints that I put into the God's Gardeners is a man who authored the Iraqi bird book with the bullets literally whizzing overhead. You know, they put that thing together under really quite dangerous conditions. One of the other people that we work with is from the Paraguay-Uruguay area, and he faced down a bunch of poachers who then issued death threats. He put the names of the poachers up on the internet. They then issued death threats to him. He put the death threats up on the internet, mm-hmm. and he finally shamed the government into acting like that. The guy who's head of it is Italian. Well, you know the reputation of Italy, shoot everything that moves. And that's what it was like when he came in. That's gone, thanks to him. Some of these people are very, very courageous. He went to, one of his first postings was to Sicily when he was somewhat younger. And he got off the plane and they said, "You're not working here." And he said, "Why is that?" And they said, "We'll show you." And they took him to where his office was supposed to be, and somebody had blown it up. So we are in the land of car bombs and death threats in some of these areas where poachers and people who want to cut down everything that grows and moves are at work.
Oh, Margaret Atwood, thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.